Welcome to The Bridge, a twice-weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. This morning, we'll hear about the Chinese-American experience in Astoria from Ronnie Law, a native Astorian of Chinese descent. His father, well-known seafood researcher Duncan Law, arrived in Astoria in the heyday of the Lower Columbia salmon industry. Also on the show, highlights of yesterday's Clatsop County Commissioners meeting. Then Mary Blake, co-chair of a campaign committee seeking to pass a $128 million bond measure for a new school campus in Seaside, tells us why she's working to get the vote out. This is Coast Community Radio. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Renewed interest in the contributions of the Chinese community to Astoria's development will be memorialized with the construction of downtown Astoria's Garden of Surging Waves. Ronald Law is a native Astorian of Chinese ancestry. On Monday night, he joined with other panelists in a community discussion about the Chinese-American experience in Astoria. In his portion of the talk, he told a standing-room-only crowd about his family's experiences in the early and mid-20th century during the peak years of the salmon industry on the Lower Columbia.
Both my parents' families immigrated or migrated to Oregon and then to Astoria. And I believe it was primarily because of the salmon industry, the salmon boom that happened. When the salmon industry took off and the technology and development of canned salmon, it was really timely for the Chinese immigrants because there were large populations that were left over wondering what to do after the railroads were completed and the gold rush and the mining were kind of dwindling. So about that time, that's when the salmon industry started really boom in this area. Salmon canneries required a large workforce of cheap and dependable workers, and the Chinese would really fit that bill real well. And I think most of you probably know at its peak, Astoria was considered the salmon capital of the world, and I think at one point during the swell, I think there was over 2,500 Chinese in this area. And I think that amounted to close to a quarter of the population. And then the Chinese population in Astoria peaked around the turn of the century, and then it tapered off for several reasons. The reasons I think of are the salmon population couldn't sustain the demand, so cannery numbers actually dwindled. I think at one point there were over 24 salmon canneries just in the Lower Columbia. Then there was the China Exclusion Act of 1882, which limited the number of Chinese immigrants. There were technological improvements, which required a lot less, a lot smaller crews. I think, I don't know if very many of you know about how the salmon canning work, but they developed a machine called the iron chink because it replaced so many of the Chinese workers. I think it could do like what 20 Chinese workers could do. So that's when that happened, that really left it so that the Chinese didn't have much to do, as much to do. And also because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, Chinese laborers, I think Uncle Dave said, there was largely probably over 90% male. And they were beginning to get old, and they couldn't work in the canneries anymore. So a lot of them either moved back to China or found something else to do. Dad started working in the salmon canneries when he was 13 or 14. He told me his original wage was 13 cents an hour. But he was still able to put himself through college. And after graduating from Oregon State, he returned to Astoria and took his one and only job at the seafood laboratory here. He really loved that job. He got to work with people in the fishing industry. I think one of his first experiments he did was during World War II, they really were short of vitamin A. I think the pilots needed, they wanted it for their eyesight. And so he would take the dogfish and extract the liver, take the livers out of the dogfish to extract the vitamin A out of it. And then eventually that became synthesized so that there was no need anymore to do that. But that was one of his first experiments. My mom's dad was a Chinese contractor. He started it for a short time around World War II because he worked at Point Adams. It was primarily a Japanese crew. And then when the war broke out, all the Japanese crew were relocated and interned Idaho and Eastern Oregon, I think. So they needed a lot of workers out at Point Adams, and so my grandfather actually recruited my dad, and that's where my dad met my mom out at Point Adams.
Ronald Law's father, Duncan Law, was a well-known seafood researcher and former Astoria City Council member. Monday night's discussion was part of a lecture series sponsored by the Lower Columbia Diversity Project and Encore, or Exploring New Concepts of Retirement Education. Details about upcoming presentations can be found on the web at lcdiversityproject.org. In yesterday's meeting of the Clatsop County Commissioners, the board heard a presentation from Stephen Blakesley, Health Promotion Specialist, Janet Evans, Juvenile Department Director, and Jill Quackenbush, Prevention Supervisor, on the Clatsop County Community Assessment, a compilation of health and wellness indicators for the county. Blakesley said the top two factors contributing to chronic illness in the county are tobacco use and obesity. Recently, Clatsop County has banned tobacco use from county buildings and the fairgrounds. Also in the presentation, Blakesley noted that in terms of self-reported physically and mentally unhealthy days in the last month, Clatsop ranks on par with Oregon for the numbers of unhealthy days, but he says the overall numbers are troubling.
We're pretty much on par with Oregon, maybe slightly above. Yet, in terms of the number of days per month, four. I think you equate that with your own life. You think 4 days a month you don't feel well, either mentally or physically. That seems to me that there's some room for improvement there.
Prevention Supervisor Jill Quackenbush said alcohol remains the drug most used by Clatsop County adults and youth, but another indicator revealed a high percentage of county youth engage in another addictive behavior.
And this isn't necessarily problem gambling, but to know that 50% of our youth are gambling and how that might lead to problem gambling.
Quackenbush added that marijuana use by 11th grade youth, while trending up over the last 10 years, remains consistent with the average in the state of Oregon, but prescription medication use by 11th grade youth is at twice the state average. Quackenbush said high addiction rates could be a strain on local resources. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health estimates that almost 1,000 Clatsop County residents aged 12 and over are in need of treatment. Quackenbush said the county's prevention efforts include law enforcement, schools, youth, and parents. The health assessment data compilation will aid in coordination of services. The health department said the assessment will also be useful for department accreditation and the state's coordinated care organization initiative. In other business, the board approved a contract with the Oregon Health Authority for outreach to those eligible for the Cover Oregon Health Insurance Program. The County Public Health Department received a $76,436 grant to fund the outreach program. Agreement with the outreach provider, Judy Mahoney, is scheduled for action at the board's September 25th meeting. Still coming up in November, Seaside voters will decide on a nearly $129 million bond measure that would build a new central school campus out of the way of tsunamis. That story coming up just after the weather. Here is the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Cloudy today and some patchy fog. Highs 65 to 75 degrees with west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy with patchy fog. Overnight lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, another cloudy day after patchy morning fog. Highs in the low 70s. And looking ahead to the weekend, cloudy on Saturday and Sunday. Daytime highs 65 to 75 degrees with overnight lows in the high 50s. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says few changes through tomorrow. Cloudy tonight with the marine layer pushing in around sunset with partial clearing this afternoon, highs around the mid-70s, lows in the mid-50s. Saturday, things start to shift as an upper-level low-pressure area nears the coast, giving us a chance of showers Saturday night into Sunday. The low will slowly drift across the region, keeping the shower threat in the forecast through at least the first half of next week. Highs down in the low 70s, lows in the low to mid 50s. Coming in November, voters in Seaside will be asked to approve a nearly $129 million bond issue that would pay for a new K-12 school campus. The campus design is intended to withstand a major earthquake, and the proposed location would put it out of reach of a tsunami. Last week, the Seaside School Board unanimously approved the wording for the measure, and a campaign committee has been formed to work for the measure's passage. Mary Blake, retired Sunset Empire Park and Recreation Manager, is co-chair of the campaign committee. In a telephone interview yesterday, she described why she feels now is the time to build the new campus.
Over the last 20 years, the science that has been generated by the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, which is known as DGAMI, has really looked at with great detail and peer review, the fault that we're living on is very vulnerable to earthquakes. And when an earthquake happens, a tsunami ensues. And a tsunami can really do havoc on coastal communities. All of our schools in Seaside School District are vulnerable, and they are in the inundation zone of a tsunami. Passage of a bond measure would construct a campus from K through 12 outside of the inundation zone and also prepare our kids and our community for the 21st century by way of educating them, giving them all the opportunities of how do you build a life, and you build that through education and experiential learning. So the idea of a campus is a brilliant one. It's more efficient. It will have a better use of staff, which is one of the largest employers in our area, the school district number 10, and it will benefit the kids. But because I was in community with Park and Recreation, I always wondered and hoped for better relationships between different agencies with the city and the school and other governmental agencies where our tax dollars go. So this campus also will enhance lifelong learning. It will then also be engineered. And this is one of the most interesting parts of it, as we have understood the power of tsunami, they understood and watched the change up of the weather related instances. It is when we have big blows and hurricane gust forms that knocked us out for 125 hours in 2007. So our building, this new campus, will be constructed seismically to handle a 9+ earthquake and a tsunami. So it will become the location where the emergency shelter for, bluntly, those survivors from a big event. So that part of the facility will not be interrupted. We will have water, sewer, lights, and that building will be sustained. So that will be after search and rescue, our recovery will take place. This is actually the time, because the bond rates are low and because of the valuation of school district number 10 is so high, we can get the money that is required to build a campus like this at a very reasonable rate. So everything about this relocation of our schools is absolutely the right time and should engage our entire community, and we should get pretty excited about it and to see the opportunities as well as deal with the planning side of it as far as the safety. So everything about it, Kathleen, is quite remarkable and has been a long public process over the last 20 years.
We've made several point-by-point arguments in favor of it. On the opposite side, this is asking people to add considerably to the amount of overall taxes that they pay in support of schools. Now, how affordable do you think that is for people?
Well, right now it's $128.8 million for the campus, and that would work out to be $2.16 per thousand. So for a $100,000 house, it would be $216 a year. Or if you extrapolate that out, a $200,000 house, just over $400 a year. And the average house around here is about $180,000 to $200,000. So we're talking about $1 a day.
And for how many years does this go on?
It's a 30-year bond.
That's on top of over $800 or so per year that people are already paying in support of schools.
We do support our schools. We do support our schools through our tax base, tax process. And, you know, when I look at that, is that a great bargain? I guess it certainly is, because it's our future. It also sets people up for paying it forward, so to speak. We want the best education possible, and I received that when I was growing up, and I want to be able to be a part of providing that for the kids in schools now. So as I continue to age, and my mother's 95 and I'm 63 now, so I've, you know, potentially have another 30 years, I want to bring in an educated force of young people that will do the same in that process of paying it forward and supporting education and supporting a quality of life in an area in which I have chosen to live. And that's one of those pieces. That's probably, if anybody was to say, well, gosh, it's a great idea, Mary, but really it's that ticket to, you know, how do we pay for that, or how do we do that? And I think that's the piece where we start looking at our own incomes. How do we invest in the future? Who is going to invest in the future if we feel we can't come up with that, you know, extra dollar or $2 a day? So that's that real conversation of what do we do together to build a future that is ready for the 21st century, that is safe for our community, that is you know, promoting lifelong learning. So yeah, it's an investment, and that's how I see it.
Part of this $128 million is a purchase price for property the school district doesn't yet own. And could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. When we really looked at the schools and could they just be rebuilt there, is that they are in the inundation zone. So then we started looking around for a large piece of property within our whole district that could handle it, that would be outside the new inundation zone. The inundation zone is 80 feet up. So what that did is that the only land that's above that is really forested land. So it's been years in the effort of talking to Weyerhaeuser and talking to the state for, because it's going to require a number of things, rezoning, the property that could handle a building this size we're talking about, you know, the equivalent to what the schools are now. It's just about 300,000 square feet plus the boundaries around it. So it's a 50-acre parcel of land. And if you're familiar with the footprint of School District Number 10, it is just beyond Seaside Heights. So Seaside Heights, the parking lot, you will go east and go up for a 50-acre piece. We're actually going to have a Run for Your Life on October 5th, where people can come up there and actually get into the forest and see sort of the start of clearing the area. The purchase, the land has not been purchased yet, because that was one of the pieces that is in the bond. And so, you know, the land has not been purchased, but it has been, they've been negotiating with it for quite some time, and so that's where we are. It can and will be zoned by way of the state. The school district has worked with the state regarding that, and they are dealing with the owners of the land, so I think that we will be able to, you know, strike that deal. So the land, that's sort of the update on the land, to the best of my knowledge right now.
Well, I do have to draw our talk to a close. Thank you very much, Mary Blake, for talking about the bond measure today.
Kathleen, thank you, and also for all your great, smart listeners out there. It's a real privilege.
Bye-bye now.
Well, that's all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs Tuesday and Thursday mornings at 9. Next week, we'll hear about some of the results from public meetings about Astoria's transportation plan. Thanks for listening. We welcome your feedback on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. Let us know what you think, and please let us know about story ideas you'd like us to take a look at. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.